Welcome to Hebrew Bible Insights, a podcast about making sense of the Hebrew Bible. I'm Matthew Delaney. Today I have a very special episode for you all. I have an interview with Dr. Voth, and I'm really excited for this. Now, part of this episode might seem a little left field for a Hebrew Bible Insights podcast. Why are we doing an episode about C.S. Lewis? Well, I figure that a number of people who are interested in the Bible are also interested in C.S. Lewis. He is one of the perennial influences of the last century. And I think there's a lot that we can learn from him. And this will be a fascinating conversation I think many of you will enjoy, as I did myself. Now, I got to tell you about Dr. Jeff Voth. He's a great person, a fascinating person, and I'm really glad I get to have him on. In his words, he would describe himself as a kindler of fire, and I have to say I agree. I've known him both as a coworker at the same university, as well as I knew about him when he was a professor during my undergraduate years. And some of my friends took his classes, and I've gotten to see what he's like. And a kindler of fire is definitely what he is. I've had some great personal conversations where he's been a great mentor to me. In fact, what comes to my mind is Paul's words in 2 Timothy 1:6, where Paul says, "For this reason I remind you to fan into flame the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of my hands." Dr. Voth is someone that you're going to walk away feeling greater passion for life and greater passion for God. So Dr. Voth, a few things about him. There's a lot to say, but I'll leave it at this. He's a professor of practical ministry at Oral Roberts University. He has a doctorate of ministry leadership in community spiritual formation from Denver Seminary. He has a master's of divinity from ORU, as well as a master's of arts with an emphasis in philosophy, apologetics, and Christian worldview from Trinity Theological Seminary. But he's not just someone of the university. He has a passion for reaching people in all sectors of society. He is the pastor of 3434 Church, as well as an author and founder of Cave Time, which is a men's ministry where he impacts a lot of people through experiences, expeditions, books, and other types of influencing means. What means a lot to me is that he's also a family man with his wife, his grown kids, and his grandchildren. Today, though, we're talking about his newest book that he's released, which is about C.S. Lewis. His book is called Why Lewis? Seven Reasons for Why C.S. Lewis is the Second Most Influential Author in Modern Christian History. This book is a great resource for anyone who's wanting to learn more about C.S. Lewis, especially with how do you talk about C.S. Lewis, someone who has he has a huge impact. He's written fiction. He's written kids' books. He's written for adults. He's written nonfiction. He's written apologetic books. He's done imaginative forays into deep theology. There's a lot to the person of C.S. Lewis, and it can almost be overwhelming to approach. And what Dr. Voth has written is a really simple, clear primer of here's an introduction to C.S. Lewis. It's a great first stop to make when entering into C.S. Lewis studies, or maybe you already know about some of his work. So I highly recommend it. I really enjoyed it. He was gracious enough to send me a copy to read. So I'm excited for our conversation with us today. And although we don't necessarily touch on Hebrew Bible, don't worry, we'll get back to that in future episodes. But I just thought this will be a great opportunity, and I think this will be a conversation that will bless you as it did me. So as always, if this is helpful, leaving reviews, sharing the podcast is helpful. And I hope that through these podcasts, people will have a deeper passion for God, a deeper passion for loving other people, a deeper passion for life. And so today we have a great conversation with Dr. Voth ahead of us. And without further ado, let's dive into my conversation with Dr. Jeff Voth. Dr. Voth, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast. Our super special guest, have a lot of people excited to hear from you. Thanks for being on.
Yeah, I am honored to be here. You yourself are a rock star at our school here, so I'm honored to be with you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
So first thing, maybe someone who's listening, they happen to not be familiar with you or your work. I wonder if you can just tell us a little about yourself. You're involved in a lot of different things and your influence. Can you maybe give us a picture of you?
I am the kindler of fire. Yeah, some people know me as Jeff Voth, Pastor Jeff. I'm kindler of fire. It may seem like I do three things. I'm a university professor, which I absolutely love. I am a pastor of a local church. And then I have an international men's ministry called Cave Time, where I get to run around the world and build better men. But I really see myself as doing one thing. I love to kindle fire, whether that's academic fire, whether that is spiritual fire, whether that is, you know, a fire in men to be men, and all of those things, I think, complement one another. I love to kindle fire in people's lives and hearts. And
is it too early for me to say that this feels very Lewis-esque almost?
And we'll paint a picture for those listening. There's a picture of him behind us.
Yep.
Looking down.
Yes, right. He is looking down. Looking down,
kind of
right
with
now.
That little smile. And yeah, it's just, it's a great, great space here we've got.
So how did you first get interested in Lewis? Where were you first exposed to him? And why do you have you had such a long, enduring interest in him?
Yeah, you know, mine didn't start as early as some because I didn't grow up in a Christian home. So I didn't know who Aslan and, Reepicheep and all of the characters in those great chronicles were until college. And so in college, Mere Christianity, my roommate, showed me a copy of Mere Christianity, and I read some things in there, and I was mesmerized. I didn't obviously understand everything, because Mere, you need to read a few times and you always get something new.
Yeah.
But I was pulled in, and then I realized I had heard of the Chronicles, and so started reading the Chronicles and really dived into the Chronicles when I had my own children. So it wasn't until in my late 20s that I really dived in, and just then Lewis started saying things. Frederick Buechner has a book called They Say What We Feel. I love the title of that book. It's a great book, by the way. But Lewis does that for me. I read something and I'm like, I feel that. And he has language for it. And so there was more and more of that, and I kept reading more and more books and couldn't get enough. And then I just liked him as a guy. He is, to me, the working man's scholar. Brilliant, but really makes these high, lofty ideas palatable for the rest of us.
Yes.
And I appreciate that about him.
Yeah. Sometimes I wonder, he taught at Oxford.
Yeah.
And when you think about some of the stereotypical high academic culture, I wonder how he was treated by fellow academics. What are they thinking? Okay, this guy, he's writing fiction books. Oh, he's writing, yes, deep apologetic books, but from the academic perspective, it's like, well, why would you write something for that everyone can grasp?
Yeah, they had a disdain for that. I personally think they were probably jealous because he was cranking out quite a few books. You're in the academic world yourself, and we're teaching. Then you have to write. And so this guy was cranking out. His productivity was absolutely amazing, very prolific. I think people were jealous by that. And so how people react to that, and they had a disdain for it. But he was just absolutely brilliant in the things that he could crank out and grasp these high, lofty philosophical ideas from Plato, Aristotle, and all kinds of philosophers that the regular person would never even know. Lewis takes these ideas and makes them real, and then does something that not a lot of people do. He writes stories to bring these ideas, these fiction pieces alive. And so you can look at some of the Space Trilogy, and he wrote, he would write a nonfiction piece to elucidate that. That's pretty cool.
Yes.
And he could do that. I would challenge, and that's one of the things in my recent book, one of my reasons for Lewis being as influential as he is and still is, that is his ability to take, fiction and write a nonfiction piece and marry them and merge them and have them kiss one another.
Yes. That was one of the most fascinating reasons you gave in your book. In fact, I would love to get to talk about that. Maybe we do this first. Let's just go ahead and talk about the new work you have.
Yeah.
You've written what you call a Lewis Primer.
Yeah.
I wonder if you can just talk about what got you, what was the inspiration for this work? What is it overall? Like, what's the purpose for it?
So in Lewisian fashion, now he loved big books and things like that, but he believed in economy of verbiage. I mean, to use your words wisely and well. And so I think it would be a fitting compliment to write a primer where you could have very accessible the great Lewis quotes, reasons for, you know, maybe going further in your study of Lewis. And so that's why I did that. Everything in one place and have it be under 100 pages.
Yep. And that's one of the things I really like about your book, which is called Why Lewis.
Yeah.
One of the things I really appreciate about it is again, how accessible it is, because there are so many books out there and you always got to think, okay, how much time do I have?
Right.
How many books will I read? And while obviously there's a need for the stuff that's going to be really meaty and dense and long for certain things that we're interested in, at the end of the day, it's like, let's say I know nothing about Lewis, or maybe I know a little bit because I read Narnia, but it's like, hey, well, who was Lewis the person? Because we know his influence was vast.
Yeah.
This is a one-stop shop where in one evening or a morning on the weekend, you can get a great picture of all the different things about Lewis that makes him this perennial influencer in Christian circles.
Absolutely.
So I think it's a great book. I'm excited to talk to you about it today.
Yeah, me too. Thanks.
First thing I want to ask about is in the introduction, you kind of talk about you had a really unique, awesome opportunity for where you got to do some research for this book. Can you maybe divulge a little bit of this for us?
Matthew, I got to live in his house. I mean, who does that? We happen to be over in Ireland. And I thought, there's no way that I'm going to be that close and not pop by the kilns. And so we flew from Ireland and did a little Oxford trip. And when we went into the kilns, which was like, a holy time. And so I saw that there are people living in there. And I asked our wonderful guide, who was a student at Oxford, I asked her, I said, who's living in the house? And she said, well, resident scholars are. I said, well, I'm a scholar. How does one be a resident? And she let me know. It's, you reach out to the Lewis Foundation, which I did, and you go through a vetting process and have to be writing something and studying something. And I got chosen to live at the kilns for almost a month, be in community with some of the other scholars there who have become friends. You also get to look at manuscripts at the Bodleian and Weston libraries and vaults. And it was surreal. And I still don't have the smile off my face several years after.
It's so cool.
And it was amazing.
And if you read the introduction, you get to see some of the different people you ran into. It's super fun.
Yeah.
So you go through seven reasons for Lewis. Obviously, right. There are more, but you go through seven.
I started with 10.
Okay.
And then I thought we blew by the primer category. It just, I culled it down to seven. Yeah, I think there could be more. Mm-hmm. And what I challenged students to do in our class last year, I presented this material in a classroom setting. Mm-hmm. And they really responded. They had reasons that were other than the ones that I gave. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of Lewis. I think, as you said, he's perennial and there's a pretty deep well there to draw from. But yeah, I culled it down to seven.
Which, again, it's still important because on one hand, you talk about how famous he is. Even today, the numbers for his books are tremendous. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't know this. Up until Harry Potter, the best-selling kids fiction series.
Isn't that amazing?
Of all time.
Yeah.
And look, by the way, losing out to Harry Potter is not a bad thing. I mean, you talk about the first billionaire author. But still, there are probably a lot of people where maybe we only know him. Oh, he wrote some random fiction series. Or maybe we only know that pastors kind of like to quote him.
Yeah.
But again, there's so much depth to this person. So I'm glad we have this book that hopefully another more generations of people can realize this is someone who he has by no means been forgotten, but he also should not even get close to forgotten.
Yeah, well put. I agree.
One of the reasons I want to ask you about, you talk about his inner circle that he had.
Yeah.
There's obviously a lot of people you go through who influenced him. One of the ones I've been most fascinated by is the Inklings.
Right.
Such an interesting group. So I kind of have like a two-part question. Is one, can you give us a little taste of who are the Inklings? Why was the group interesting to him?
Yeah.
And maybe you just answer that and I'll ask a follow-up question about that.
Yeah. So they were a group that met at the Eagle and Child Pub, which I was able to, or the Bird and Baby was another name that they called it. And just a room not much bigger than the room you and I are sitting in. And it's not a big office.
Wow.
And they would pile in there and smoke pipes and drink ale and you know, just think if you were, you know, a little bird on the wall as they're trying out a new piece, you know, Tolkien's reading The Hobbit, or Charles Williams would have been one of the Inklings as well. Lewis's close friends, again, Tolkien, Williams, some of the Greaves, the Barfield. You could go down the line, and the list is, it's a big list, but there were some regulars, the guys that I just called out to you. And that it was a group that met literally to talk about what they were working on. And so you would read a piece, and they'd comment on it. They'd cut it up, they'd push back, and that was just part of the, that's just part of the ebb and flow of Oxford, which I found out when I was over there. That's just what they do there. Hmm. That's what we would do at dinner. And the first day I was there, somebody asked me what I had written, and I was sharing something, and I got in an Oxfordian argument that is just, you know, hello, my name is, and the scholar introduced themselves, and I was, okay, that's what we do even before breakfast. And that's what they did at the Inklings. And it has, you know, become an epic group and, yeah, very influential in Lewis's life.
I mean, truly incredible to think, even just stopping after Tolkien, right? That would even be enough to think these two guys met up regularly, yeah. Let alone all that list.
Yeah.
One thing I was thinking about as I read on this, obviously you know, professor, pastor, mentor for many, cave time, all this stuff. When you think about Lewis and his inner circle, your study and your deep thinking on Lewis and his inner circle, has it affected maybe the way that maybe for us as we are trying to be people who achieve great things, who live holistic good lives? Is there any insight as you look at Lewis and then maybe looking back now on us, any pastoral advice, if you will, on this? Any thoughts you have?
Yeah, I wish we had more of what they had. Mm. We just don't have as much of that. Part of it is just the way they lived their lives. They, you know, walked to work sometimes. And I walked his trail from the Kilns is in Headington Quarry. So it's outside of Oxford, kind of in the Oxford countryside. And you can walk along the street. Literally, you take the bus line for the number 8 bus, the big red double-decker bus, and you walk. And it's a few miles, but they would walk together. Mm-hmm. They would stop at pubs on the way. And there was a friendship and a camaraderie that was cultural that I wish we had. And we love one another, and we're friends. But they really did stuff together, and I like that.
Yeah, that's special. One of the other reasons that you talk about is this whole connection between the intellect and the imagination.
Yeah.
And the way that he was able to do both, which, I mean, as you already mentioned, that's a really rare thing. Mm-hmm. Most of the time you have people who, okay, I'm specializing in fiction, creating those type of stories, or maybe I'm focusing more on just what feels intellectual. Especially if there are a lot of people listening who maybe they are pastors or want to be pastors. There's a very strong, and you obviously feel this, maybe there's a strong feel of, I got to be really practical. There are real problems in front of me. Mm-hmm. Solve the problems.
Yeah.
Or there's the professor or people who are in learning in academia as an undergraduate or graduate student, and it's like, I have to sound really smart. I got to have a great bibliography. Yeah. I got to sound, you know, really academic. And that's what I do. And so we have these pressures on trying to meet expectations, and some of them are maybe even well-intended. But maybe you can talk about maybe you can talk about what C.S. Lewis was able to do because he actually lived in both worlds.
Yeah.
And maybe do you have any advice or thoughts for us on, maybe for us, if we try to, not to be all that Lewis was, because that's a high thing to try to do.
Yeah.
But maybe to incorporate a little bit of it in our lives. Any thoughts?
Yeah. So, that whole piece of intellect and imagination, mm-hmm. we know as educators that if you have the ability, Jesus did this, didn't he? He mm-hmm. would use a parable, mm-hmm. something on a walk, and talk about the lilies and sparrows, and then he would tie that to, they don't worry. Why mm-hmm. would you worry? Look how mm-hmm. beautiful they look. And he would tie a picture to something that was concrete. And Lewis did that. He did that with his different stories, characters. There's something that I've learned about Jesus through, look at Aslan, the girl's touching him and stroking his fur, and we get an insight into God letting us touch him as we look at the picture of this lion who allowed these girls and invited them to touch him. So the use of the picture to tie me to something concrete and real is a very powerful form that he was very adept in. That's challenged me to want to do the same thing, to want to be a storyteller, but a storyteller with a purpose. And what am I tying my students to? Not just telling a story and entertaining them, but what am I appealing to with that story to teach them? Lewis does that for us. And I've really appreciated that. In my own life, it has challenged me. I think all of us probably lean towards one or the other. Maybe you like story a little more. Or maybe you like fiction and you're into numbers and graphs and charts and whatever. That's a spectrum that I think all of us should try to, you know, be adept at both. And that's what I've tried to push into. And so I've found that Lewis has been a great example. And I would challenge, if you look at others, it's a pretty small group of people who do that well.
Yeah, it's very tough to do.
Yeah, it is.
But also doesn't make it not worth to try to pursue and incorporate it, and you have a little balance.
Absolutely.
On both sides. I love that. Storyteller with a purpose. That's really good.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, for me, I personally lean a little bit more toward, you know, the straightforward talking intellect logic side as opposed to the story and the fiction. But I've learned, I mean, through some friends in the last few years, the value that, and part of it was taking a C.S. Lewis class in my undergraduate studies at ORU, and learning the value of fiction and why this stuff matters. Because sometimes I think as Christians, we almost oversimplify, well, if something didn't happen, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And instead of realizing it's a very effective communication.
Well, and if we realize what, so let's say a lot of people didn't know Lewis, really his first, the first piece that really got him respect in the literary world as a literary critic was the preface to Paradise Lost. And so many of us have probably read parts of Paradise Lost. I don't think I'd ever sat down and read it like straight through. But after reading his preface and talking about meter and word choice and Milton's own particular story, I was pulled in. And so he uses that vehicle of literary criticism and the different parts of that discipline and pulled me in. And so a lot of people don't know that was a part of his makeup, that he was a brilliant literary critic. English literature. He wrote the history, the Oxford History of English Literature.
Right.
And, it is a huge work. It took me probably a year to work through that. And just Lewis looks at every, in poetry and prose, you know, every figure in, you know, the history of English language in the 16th century. That's just brilliant. That is just brilliant. And I got to look at his notes when we were at Oxford, and they're all handwritten. So it wasn't like you and I have computers and we can click off these notes. His were all handwritten and indexed. Absolutely amazing.
So this is probably an area where I think you and Lewis have in common. Again, people probably look at Lewis and think, how did he accomplish all this?
Yeah.
How's he doing all this?
Yeah.
And obviously you're someone who most people would say, I think being a pastor would be enough, or just being a professor would be enough. And if people are listening and they're passionate, they're driven, and they feel called by God, but it's just like there's no way that they almost stop before they even start because it's just this couldn't be possible. Do you have any advice that you would give people, or any, you know, words you would say for people who, you know, again, maybe the people who are seasoned veterans in some way, right? But they're thinking about expanding into another area. In the different season of life. Do you have any thoughts or wisdom you'd give in this journey of life as we try to make an impact?
Yeah, I think the key is a good rhythm. You have to have a good rhythm. And yesterday, an Aristotle quote we were looking at in class talking about, if you want to be excellent, you essentially, he didn't use these words, you need to grind it out rhythmically on a regular basis. Decide what you want to be good at, and you need to grind it out on a regular basis. There's no substitute for that. So if you want to take in more, you want to read more, well, maybe go to bed a little earlier and get up earlier and have a specific time where you're going to read. Or I have found ways in our, you know, techno world that you can, Audible is a great way. So when I work out, I love to, I'll listen to books. Mm-hmm. I'd never read the Chronicles straight through, so I'm listening to them now straight through. And it's great. You can find them, you know, somebody's got an English accent and I'm listening to the Chronicles straight through while I work out, doing two things at once. There's a great app called Thinker. And it's an app where there are many books that I'm not going to be able to, as we sit, and there's a pile of them on a on a chair here. I may not be able to work through all of them, but the Thinker app gives you like a 20-minute overview of the thesis of a book. And that's another thing that you can sit down. So if I have an hour and I'm just sitting down, I may, you know, go through two or three of those, and I can be able to talk about Jordan Peterson. He's somebody I would love to read right now. I just don't have the time, but I've listened to some of his books or on Thinker app, and can converse with all of my students who love him right now. He's the guy.
Oh yeah, he is the guy. Everybody's talking about Jordan Peterson.
Yeah, yeah,
that's great.
Yeah,
great stuff. Kind of taking a pivot here, Aslan.
Yeah,
I mean, he's probably the most iconic.
Yeah.
Picture. If you think of C.S. Lewis, and you have to imagine something else right after him in a picture, probably Aslan's coming to mind. You talk about him. I really liked hearing some of your favorite quotes from Aslan.
Yeah.
Maybe you can talk about Aslan a little bit, and you have a really fun story about a lion that really let's just say you sold me on why Lewis chose the lion as the image for Aslan.
It's a pretty good case in the book, isn't it? Yeah it is. That's one of the stronger points. So Walter Hooper, who is just recently gone to heaven, was credited with, you know, helping preserve a lot of Lewis's work. Walter Hooper, in an interview with Eric Metaxas, was asked. Metaxas asked Walter, why a lion? You know, why did Lewis choose a lion? And Walter Hooper said, well, one wouldn't choose a platypus to be the king of the jungle now, would he? And that's just a great, there's just something about a lion. And in my own experience, happened to be in Africa several years ago, and we were out in the bush. And I'm a mountain guy, so I've never even really seen a cougar in the wild. I know they're there, but I've never, you know, like even heard one. And so we were in Africa early one morning and in the bush, and it's a, you know, it was a game preserve, but it's kind of wild. And so we're out waiting for our bus to come pick us up. We're in a parking lot, you know, out. And we hear, it was, Matthew, it was not the growl that you hear on TV before that little, that's a pussycat, the movies. I mean, this was a roar, a combination between a train, a freight train, a scream, a roar, and the ground shook, and we were afraid. I mean, there was no doubt after we'd heard that what it was. And thank God our guide got there. We got in the bus as quickly as we could, and we described to him, and he said, oh yes, the king was letting you know he was awake.
Oh man. Ooh, yeah. I can't imagine how terrifying that was.
It was terrifying. Really was.
Yeah, that story was super fun to read. Yeah, just now imagining Aslan with that is fantastic. So one of the like pretty deep parts of Lewis, and that even sometimes I remember when I was first introduced to this idea, I'm like trying to get my mind around this. I like how you put it in some pretty simple terms, this whole idea of myths, but then the true myth.
Yeah,
where for Lewis, again, he didn't grow up being a Christian. Tolkien was a big influence on his life, and they would read myths together.
Yeah,
but to Lewis it was just you know, fun. I think the phrase he used was something like myths. At the end of the day, though, there it's lying through, but breathing through silver glass or silver, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So pretty strong words. It's like, okay, he enjoys reading the Aeneid or some of the Norse myths.
Balder, right.
I mean, he enjoyed that. So anyway, maybe you can walk us through, though, from Lewis. He's starting from a place where he appreciates myths, but as a literary way, but somehow Tolkien was able to move him to this idea of a true myth, which I think for a lot of Christians or even just people, it's like, well, that's an oxymoron.
Right.
You know what I mean? Mythbusters is like, what do you mean? Like true, like let's do the true myth, put on Mythbusters, instantly bested, episode over after 1 minute.
Yeah.
Myth, but there's something deep there. What's this idea of the true myth?
So Lewis was drawn to Tolkien because of his love for Norse mythology. And so he had read Norse mythology, and he actually became a member of the Kolbiters, which is a group that Tolkien had. And it was called Kolbiters because it was so cold in his room where they met that you had to get like close enough to the coal to bite it. And so they would talk about these myths and then in different cultures. And you know, when you study these ancient mythologies, these cosmologies, if you would, of different cultures, Near Eastern and even Far Eastern, there are some commonalities from epic floods to snakes to, you know, talking animals to, you know, all kinds of things that they're common. And in their talk about creation and in their talk about mythology, Tolkien brought up to Lewis that you like mythology and you're drawn towards mythology, but I think there could be one faith that has the truest mythology, and that would be the Judeo-Christian telling of this. And that led Lewis on, you know, on a journey to consider that. And that's when Tolkien coined the famous Mythopoeia, which is, I believe, 148 lines of absolutely brilliant, you know, just a luring and pulling Lewis into that vortex that the reason you believe all of these things is because there is one place that they're true and you want them to be true. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
You want them to be true. Tolkien proposed to Lewis that in Christianity they in fact are. So when we talk about mythology in that context, that creation myth that all cultures have, how we got here and what the story is. And so Tolkien proposed to Lewis that maybe there are all these different stories and they have shreds of common themes because there was one story. And cultures have splintered and gone their own ways, but there was one story. And then he proposed ultimately that it was the Judeo-Christian story and the person of Jesus. And Lewis, over the years, really refined that argument that it's, you know, a real mythology that is tethered to ultimately a real man who came at a real time under the governance of Rome and Pontius Pilate and died a real death. And you can check that out. That's brilliant. And that is really, it's helped me in my own walk and students, once we talk them through that, they really get that. Because if you've read, you realize Gilgamesh and some of these stories, you're like, that really sounds like some of ours. And there could be a case that maybe Gilgamesh is even older and predates some of our, you know, the creation story. Well, what does that mean? If that's first, is ours copying? And Tolkien and ultimately Lewis would say, no, it's not. It's just that's the truest telling. And maybe there's a text that may be older than the other, but they're really telling the same story. The Judeo-Christian telling is the most truthful.
Yeah, so I guess it almost gets into the idea that any story that's true, that is honestly told, that, you know, tells things about humanity in an honest way.
Right.
It will lead us, if you will, in a way, maybe indirect a bit, but leads us to the cross. That they do lead us to this idea that humanity has a problem, that, you know, we need some sort of hero.
Mm-hmm. And you can get all sorts of the different nuances and details. But this idea that the Judeo-Christian story, it's almost like the official canonized or canonical version of maybe.
So yeah, you have Jesus who is, in other mythologies, you have the Phoenix, the Corn King. Mm-hmm. You have, you know, throughout history, it's that Jesus was the personification of that. Yeah, it's a great point.
In fact, that's one of the things you mentioned with Lewis is, how did you put it? I think some of the book you said something like how through Lewis you see Jesus.
Absolutely.
Where yeah. I guess this is almost getting to maybe the deepest purpose of why Lewis, you know, is almost a, do you see almost like a Paul, follow me as I follow Christ type of thing with Absolutely. Lewis, you know?
He's unashamedly pointing people to Jesus, unashamedly getting them to the telling of the greatest story. Mm-hmm. And the story of Jesus, the one who is the true consummation of all of those things that the other myths are trying to tell in the person of Jesus. Mm. And he says that recurrently.
So just kind of a random question. I was curious, in your research, was there anything that surprised you? Anything that was just interesting, maybe you hadn't known before or thought of before?
I don't know if it surprised me. I absolutely love, the more I've dived into this, Lewis has a term he likes. It's called the supposal, and I've used it. It's absolutely brilliant, and he uses it in the context of something like the Great Divorce when he's, you know, says, I'm not defending, you know, purgatory. It's just a supposal that if there's something else, you know, maybe what could it be? And so we have the great bus ride. I think that's brilliant. So that's, it was very surprising that he is able to maybe introduce some interesting doctrinal things.
Yeah.
And then use the supposal, say, you know, I'm not saying that this is the way it is, but suppose if it were.
Yeah. Yeah. Just an interesting way to approach
it. Isn't that brilliant? Yeah.
So different kind of question. If someone, you know, they push you in a corner and you have to decide, what is your favorite reason? You got seven good ones. If you had to choose a personal favorite, would you be able to? And what would it be?
Yeah, the language he gives me for Jesus. That'd be my love the lion. And I love language for heaven that, you know, Aslan and those stories give us to go into heaven, Narnia. You always go further up and further in. You can never plumb everything there. I was actually using that in a conversation with an elder at our church the other day, and he was we were talking about heaven, and you know, and he said, "How big is heaven?" And boom, immediately, further up and further in. You can't plumb it all, but it'll be fun trying. And yeah, so that'd be my favorite.
Yeah, some of the ways that it's just amazing how he can put into words. Into pictures.
Yeah.
And there's just a line that just hits you like a ton of bricks. And it's just exactly, you know, obviously, how does one really describe heaven? How do you really describe the power of Jesus? Yet he finds a way to get us a little bit closer.
Yeah.
And at least for me, I find myself feeling moments of awe, which I know sometimes things become so normal and average. And unfortunately, even sometimes when reading through the Bible, it's, oh, I've heard this story before. Okay, yeah. Whatever. I found for me personally, he's found a way to make things fresh again and to return back to an awe of Jesus and his ways. So very powerful.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, so a couple last questions.
Yeah.
So one would be, do you have a favorite fiction and a favorite nonfiction book of Lewis?
Favorite fiction. I love Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Classic.
I just love that. I love what it does. I love how it introduces us to Aslan. I love probably one of my favorite parts of that dialogue is when Mr. Beaver, they're talking about, you know, the kids hadn't seen Aslan yet, and they're talking about him being a lion, and you know, the kids ask, is he safe? And Mr. Beaver says, of course he's not safe. He's a lion, but he's good.
Yeah.
How brilliant is that, right?
Yep.
Good, but not safe. I've used that in like a real life that's God. That's, you know, you go to the wilderness and see the Rocky Mountains, and they are good. They're beautiful and they're great, but there's stuff that's not safe out there.
Yeah.
And I really love that. So nonfiction would then be, so fiction is Lion, Witch, in the Wardrobe. Mm-hmm. Nonfiction, and I'm looking at, I have several copies of it on my shelf up here, would be A Grief Observed. Mm. It's been the most practical tool that I've used pastorally, where he actually works out his own faith and his response when his wife dies of cancer. And it's so brilliantly done. It's, you know, readable. It's small. You can read it in a setting or two. And it really just helps process grief and without losing your faith.
Yeah.
It's brilliantly done.
That's really good.
Yeah.
I've really enjoyed our conversation. Really just now I just want to open it up. If there's any last thoughts that you'd want to share about Lewis? And also if you can just share, what's your book called? Where can we find it? And that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Couple thoughts. Like maybe the best biography of Lewis I found to be, it's one that it's a little harder to find. It's called Lenten Lands. It's by Douglas Gresham, who was his stepson. Doug has actually become a personal friend, and it's, you know, you can't beat primary source insight. And he gives some insight in his book there that I would really encourage. So if people are asking the question, I'd start with Lenten Lands. Doug's is a great picture of, you know, a 17-year-old. He met, you know, Lewis when he was a kid, and Lewis, I think, passed when he was 17. And so it's great insight. I would encourage that. It could, because there are all kinds of biographies out there. So
sure.
I would reach for that one. My book is called Why Lewis. Came out just a couple of weeks ago. You can get it online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, my publisher, Wiffenstock. And it is available and readable. And I would encourage you to go out and buy a million or so copies.
Yeah, a million.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, that would be great. No, yeah, I'll put links to everything in the podcast show notes. And again, you were very gracious to give me a copy. Very much enjoyed reading it. And
awesome.
It reads just like a conversation, kind of just like what we're doing here. Very readable and very accessible. And you'll walk away saying, okay, this is something I can read. And we'll walk away, whether maybe you know only a part of Lewis or nothing of Lewis, and walk away feeling inspired to both want to engage more with Lewis, but also to engage more with life. And so I think it's a great book, and I'm really excited for more people to get to read it.
Yeah.
So thank you for coming on the show to get to talk about it.
Absolutely. Appreciate it.
Loved it.